It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It's tax season and time for millions of Americans to file their tax returns. And no surprise, dealing with that paperwork is not one of America's favorite pastimes. In fact, surveys show that some Americans say they'd rather get a root canal than file their taxes. You might wonder, if the government already has most of our financial information, why do taxpayers have to jump through all the hoops to file themselves? Imagine if many people could have their taxes done without filing a return at all. Where does that wild science fiction idea come from? Here's President Ronald Reagan speaking in 1985.
We envision a system where more than half of us would not even have to fill out a return. We call it the return-free system, and it would be totally voluntary. If you decided to participate, you would automatically receive your refund or a letter explaining any additional tax you owe. Should you disagree with this figure, you would be free to fill out your taxes using the regular form. We believe most Americans would go from the long form or the short form to no form.
Our next guest studies tax law and the IRS. She has ideas on how to simplify tax season and why those changes haven't happened. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you file your taxes? Do you use old-fashioned pen and paper or a program online, free, or do you pay? Does somebody do your taxes for you? Do you hire an accountant, a bookkeeper to make the process easier? Do you think there's got to be a better way? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Beverly Moran is a professor emerita of law at Vanderbilt University and an expert in U.S. tax law. She previously taught at UW Law School. Beverly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you wrote about this actually a couple years ago and referenced that idea in a piece you wrote from former President Ronald Reagan. Can you talk about that idea of return-free tax system? Is it something we could pull off in the United States?
Well, what's fascinating is in most of Europe, people already have return-free tax systems. And even in other parts of the world where there might be a return, the U.S. return is more complicated and more stressful than in other parts of the world. We spend more time as individuals on our taxes, and we spend more money preparing them as well.
Why is that? Why are American taxes more complicated to fill out than, say, comparable European nations?
Well, part of it is political lobbying by the paid tax preparers. And by that, I want to be clear. I'm not talking about your personal accountant, but more about like H&R Block, TurboTax, these very large companies that provide filing assistance for people who are basically walking in from the street, you know, so that you don't have like a long-term relationship with them. And there's been a number of investigative journalist reports over the past 5 years, particularly in ProPublica, showing how much money these companies spend on lobbying for the purpose of keeping the filing as complicated and as frightening as possible.
One change we've seen over the years is online filing, and nowadays you can go to the IRS website and they will give you the option, if you meet certain criteria, to file for free with an outside company. You can't do it directly through the IRS. Is that a similar thing where lobbying has prevented just the IRS from putting a file here at irs.gov?
Absolutely. And what happened was that in the year 2000, Congress directed the Internal Revenue Service to create a situation where people who were earned in the bottom 70% of incomes would have access to free filing. The IRS then entered into a contract with a number of these private companies to have them do the free filing for the IRS. So that's the system that you're explaining. You go to the IRS website and you see a number of choices of companies that you can pick to do your free filing. Well, what happened, and this was according to the Inspector General for Administration at the Treasury Department, was that these companies, particularly Intuit and H&R Block, created algorithms in the website so that when the taxpayer went from the IRS website to the private tax returner's website, that the taxpayer would constantly get thrown out of the free tax return. And so, just as you pointed out, most people would rather have a root canal than do their taxes. So if they're going to the website and they're filling everything out, and they didn't want to do it to begin with, right? And then they're told at the very end, oh, you're going to get a $700 refund, but it's going to cost you $50. But we're not going to actually charge you the $50. We're just going to take that $50 from your return. So instead of getting a $700 refund, you'll get a $650 refund. Most people are just going to throw up their hands and pay. They're not going to say, wait a second, this was supposed to be a free filing. And as a result, less than 4% of the American public gets this free filing. And it got so bad that once the IRS figured out that this was going on and kept pressuring the companies to do the right thing, Intuit left. They just said, if you're going to make us do this, you know, free filing for 70% of the American public, we're just going to leave the program. And instead, what they did was they started an advertising program called Free. So you may have remembered it from past tax seasons that, you know, free, 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 free. But in fact, it was the same thing where people were going in and filling out their returns and getting to the last step and discovering that, oh, they had to pay the $50 or the, you know, the $75 or whatever. And so even after they left the program, there was still this situation where less than 4% of the American public were getting free filing. And it got so bad that the FTC fined Intuit for claiming that it was providing free returns when it was not.
Beverly Moran.
This is a huge industry. Yes?
We're talking to Beverly Moran, Professor Emerita of Law at Vanderbilt University, expert in U.S. tax law, asking the question, why is it so complicated to fill out our taxes here in the U.S.? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Well, Beverly and Rob, I am actually singing to the choir today, but I can recommend a good endodontist in Fitchburg, Wisconsin, for root canals. He did an excellent job. I mean, I have now 15, maybe 20 years of taxes filed this way, for which I paid fees year after year. I just filed for 5 days ago and paid $55 for federal and state. And, you know, what happens is if you have a little bit of non-employee compensation, a little 1099 miscellaneous income, you know, you're technically self-employed. That doubles the price. And, you know, you made, what, $1,600 in income? It's ridiculous. The thresholds are insane, you know, for the fees that they want to charge. And shouldn't the action be here a combined assault from the IRS and the Department of Justice with a huge class action suit on behalf of federal and state taxpayers nationwide to simply get all that lobbying cash back from Congress and into our refund checks.
Tom, thanks for the call. A lot there, Beverly. First of all, a lot of little wrinkles can make people, as Tom points out, ineligible for that free tax filing or bump up what they have to pay. In his case, a little bit of outside non-employment income.
Well, that still leaves 70% of the people in the United States who should be getting easy free filing. So what's happening with those people? And also, at least my experience, because one of the things I do every year is file free for people who, you know, can't afford it, just so I can see how the system is working. And I'll give you one example where I went to the website, the IRS website. I looked at what the criteria were for each company. I picked one company, I filed, I got to the last moment and I was being charged. So I called the company and I said, why am I being charged? And they said, well, this person has an earned income tax credit and any credit, we're not going to give you free filing. Now, the criteria that this company had posted online as to who could get free filing, anybody who met that criteria was going to have an earned income tax credit. Hmm. So essentially, they were never going to give anybody free filing. So it's not just that not everyone is covered. It's that the people who are covered are not being given access because the private companies are setting it up so that you can't get access, even though based on all the rules, you should be getting free filing.
And Tom suggests as a remedy, lawsuits, class action, or something led by the government. Is that something you think should happen or could help?
Well, I think that one thing that could help is educating congressmen about what is in the bills that they're proposing. Because what happens with lobbying is that a lobbyist shows up with a pre-written bill. And often there are things in that bill that the congressman does not catch. So, for example, in 2019, John Lewis, who, you know, has since passed, who was a congressman from Georgia and, you know, a very pro-taxpayer congressman, right? He supported a bill that was purported to be a bill for taxpayers. And within that bill was a provision that would have made it illegal for the IRS to ever provide free tax filing directly. I don't believe that he understood that that was in the bill. And in fact, when companies like ProPublica started to make it public that was going on, that got taken out of the bill. And I don't think it was taken out of the bill because the Congress people who were supporting it were afraid or embarrassed. I think they really didn't know. And that's one of the things that's so frightening about lobbying is there are literally hundreds of lobbyists just who do nothing but go from congressman to congressman trying to push various tax provisions. And it's very difficult for the staffs and the congresspeople to follow all of these. So this is where people like you and the rest of the journalism community are extremely important, getting the word out so that our representatives actually know what's going on.
Beverly Moran is with us, Professor Emerita of Law at Vanderbilt University. Her work focuses on tax law and the IRS. She's with us to talk about why tax preparation can be such a bureaucratic maze in the United States, what it would take to adopt a simplified model that would save taxpayers time and money. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would make filing your taxes easier or more approachable? Have you gone to file taxes for free via a link maybe on the IRS website and then found out partway through or right at the end it wasn't free? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Vanderbilt University tax law professor Beverly Moran about why filing taxes is so complicated in the United States, what it could look like to switch to return-free filing for many people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Julie is with us in Evansville. Julie, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, yeah, this was a few years ago. My husband waited until he was 70 to start taking Social Security, and he took it mid-year. And when he was preparing, he's very organized. He has spreadsheets and everything to give to our tax preparer. But he didn't include income from Social Security, and probably because he's so organized, our tax preparer just assumed everything was there, and it got missed. And maybe 3 or 4 months after we had filed, my husband noticed the mistake and reported us and paid right away. And they just wanted to slam us. I think they wanted a $1,700 penalty and interest. And our preparer said we could send a kind of forgive us IRS for we have sinned letter to just a one-time dispensation for the penalty. It took almost 2 years back and forth, and it was unbelievable. We felt abused, and it just seemed incredibly unfair.
Julie, thanks for the call. And Beverly, I think a lot of people go into tax filing with some fear that even with an honest mistake like Julie and her husband, they may end up in hot water with the IRS. Can we take some of that fear, stress, and then real risk that Julie faced out of the equation?
We could. We don't. I mean, for example, there was a proposal that actually passed to fund the IRS, to give an extra $80 billion to the IRS. Why was that important, particularly for people like this lady and her husband? Because what has been going on is that for years, since the second George Bush administration, I mean, George Bush the son, there's been this pressure to cut the IRS funding. And when that happens, then at the same time, Congress says to the IRS, we want to see so many audits, we want to see so many people, paying penalties, etc. And so when that happens, the IRS has to go for the low-hanging fruit. This man told them that he had done something, right? So they didn't have to investigate it. They didn't have to audit it. He wasn't a person who had a lawyer who could protect him or a large accounting firm. And if you look, since these cuts have been going on with the IRS, the audits of wealthy people have become less and less and less and less. And when this $80 billion was set aside for the IRS, what happened was that the Republican Congress then started to put all sorts of pressure through this funding the deficit, the debt limit, to cut back on what the IRS was being funded. So the more that the IRS has its funding cut back, the more poor people, really poor people, and middle class people are going to be subject to audits, because the IRS has to audit someone. Congress is making them audit people. And if they don't have the resources to audit wealthy people, they will audit poorer people. This is why the one county in the United States that has the most audits per capita is one of the poorest counties in the United States.
And just
if that's what. Sorry, go ahead.
In just our last minute, Beverly, I saw the IRS is doing this pilot program for direct file to the IRS in a bunch of states, not including Wisconsin. Is this something that encourages you that, hey, maybe we will be tackling some of these problems in just our last minute or so?
Yes, absolutely. It's a very encouraging sign. And if there's anybody listening outside of Wisconsin who's in one of those states, I would encourage you to try it.
Beverly, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Go Badgers. Thanks.
That's Beverly Morena, Professor Emerita of Law at Vanderbilt University, formerly at the UW Law School, and an expert in U.S. tax law. We've been talking about why tax preparation in the U.S. is so complicated, along with challenges to creating a new system as we approach another tax season. If you have a story you'd still like to share, you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. If you've run into trouble filing taxes, or if you've started a process that you thought was going to be free and turned out not to be free, love to hear about that. Again, you can email ideas@wpr.org. And remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org. You can stream these conversations live, go back and check them out later, or share them with friends and family. Plus, follow the great coverage of the Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR news teams while you're there. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Both presidential frontrunners this campaign season have faced investigations over their handling of classified documents after they left the White House. Joe Biden from his time as vice president, Donald Trump from his time as president. An investigation last week found it can't be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that President Biden had intended to share classified information. Special Counsel Robert Hur controversially said that a jury might see Biden as, quote, an elderly man with poor memory in his report. Meanwhile, former President Trump is awaiting trial in his case. Prosecutors have charged him with willfully keeping and hiding classified materials at Mar-a-Lago. We're taking a look at the law on classified information and comparing the cases of Biden and Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the Biden and Trump classified documents cases? Do you agree with Biden not being charged while Trump has been charged? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Adam Stevenson is a clinical professor and director of the Frank J. Remington Center at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've learned, and I think a lot of people have learned as all this has been going on with both presidential candidates here, just having classified information at home after leaving the White House doesn't appear to result in prosecution. Intent and willful taking and sharing of these things seems to be a part of the question. How important is that as a factor in deciding to prosecute or not to prosecute?
It's probably one of the biggest factors, especially in the cases of President Biden and President Trump. With regard to the law underlying the willful retention of documents, there really are just actually three parts. One, that an individual is not authorized to possess the item, which after the presidency and after the vice presidency, neither President Trump nor President Biden were. The other part is that it was related to national defense, and then these documents, both Afghanistan and other foreign and domestic intelligence sources does. And then the critical element, the critical third part, is that willful retention. And it's a heightened burden of proof, a heightened burden of intent that a person actually basically intends or has the purpose to violate the law, essentially doing it flagrantly rather than accidentally. And in both cases, I think that's where the difference hinges. And in particular, as you referenced in President Biden's case, Special Counsel Herr felt that it was not going to be crystal clear that President Biden had that willful intent.
I want to talk about the process here for investigating this in the first place. We have claims about concerns about former Vice President Biden being investigated by an administration led by current President Biden and his attorney general that he had appointed. Can you talk about the decision to have this special counsel, someone who'd been a Trump appointee? Did that, to you, give enough insulation and transparency into how the administration investigated basically its own leader?
Yes, I think among the options available to the administration, I think this was about the best option it had. That was appointment of a special counsel and a special counsel with some connection to a different administration, prior administration. I think what also helps is the publication of a pretty extensive report on the findings, both factual and also the determinations made with regard to the charges. That helps with transparency fairly significantly. The document that Special Counsel Herr put out, over 300 pages long, goes into great detail about why, I should say, its investigative methods, why it chose not to prosecute, both on the facts, as well as in employing its prosecutorial discretion. And so I think given the circumstances where there might not have been a better option, it was definitely the best option available.
Biden supporters and President Biden himself not necessarily dancing with glee at the non-prosecution decision. Some of the detail you just mentioned called into question President Biden's memory after interviews with the special counsel. Some concerns that there was some editorializing unneeded, especially in an election year. Your thoughts on just how far into detail the special counsel went there?
Yeah, I think it was important to really get into the weeds on behalf of Special Counsel Herr. Exactly what characterizations may have been made and whether they were accurate, it's hard to say without having heard the investigation and the interviews. But given the importance, the sitting president in this case and his memory and the potential charges that may flow from his possession of the classified documents, I think it was important. I think one thing that is important about the context of the memory is that President Biden is in a unique position in that as vice president, he was authorized to have these documents. As president, he was authorized to have these documents, including at his home or at other locations. It was the period during the Trump administration when President Biden was not in office that's the relevant time period. And so the memory dating back to those 4 years, which was important here, that doesn't in any way excuse lapses in memory or misremembering things, but it was relating to periods several years ago, not necessarily contemporaneous events.
Adam Stevenson is with us from the UW Law School, looking at classified documents investigations. No charges against President Biden for taking documents after leaving the White House as vice president, and ongoing charges against former President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if maybe the guest could help with the definitions of classified. Are there different levels of classified documents? Could they just be handwritten notes and sketches or diaries? We all kind of have an understanding of top secret. And then I guess perhaps there's another level even beyond that. But maybe just to help us understand what types of documents each of the three individuals had in their possession.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Fantastic question, because classified could mean high levels, you know, current disposition of nuclear weapons down to, I took these notes during a meeting. What are some of the different things we mean when we talk about classified documents, Adam?
That is an excellent question. It's been really interesting. Frankly, it's something I have not had prior opportunity to deal with. Classification is actually a regime set out by the executive branch, by the president. And it's actually governed primarily by what are called executive orders, orders issued by the president. And these are executive orders dating back to 1995, amended in 2003 and 2009. And that sets out a three-tiered system of confidential information, secret information, and top secret information. But those are the sort of default three levels. There's further complications that we've heard about in especially President Trump's circumstances. SCI, sensitive compartmented information, SAP, special access programs, and those are sort of add-ons to the overall classification three-tiered regime. And so those are all set out by executive order. It actually includes who can access those various levels of information. And in each, there needs to be a appropriate level of clearance. In other words, someone has the appropriate clearance to see top secret information, a signing of a non-disclosure agreement, but also a need to know. And in both President Biden's case during when he was not in office and President Trump after his presidency, the government at least alleges or indicates that neither president had obtained a written waiver of that need to know. So even if they might have had clearance, they didn't have that need to know, which is required by the executive order to actually be able to obtain the documents or to hold the documents. Another thing that the caller asked that I think is important, especially as it relates to President Biden and perhaps the difference in the cases, is notes or journals or diaries. So not things drawn in the margin, but maybe separate notebooks or separate, I believe, index cards in President Biden's example. There is actually a bit of a lack of clarity about whether presidential personal records or notes written by the president or the vice president in Vice President Biden's case are considered themselves classified records. This is where we get into another area of law or another law called the Presidential Records Act, where, and the special counsel's report actually notes this, President Reagan had kept certain notes and journals that contained confidential information, but they themselves were not necessarily confidential documents or documents that were source documents. And so part of the thing that special counsel Hur determined was that as it related to President Biden's journals or notes, that there was perhaps ambiguity about whether those documents were subject to this classification regime and the unlawful retention laws because of the past precedent from President Reagan.
Thanks again for the call, Mike. We're talking to Adam Stevenson, clinical professor and director of the Frank J. Remington Center at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're looking at classified document investigations in the cases of former President Donald Trump, current President Joe Biden, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the Biden and Trump classified documents cases? Is there something confuses you that you have questions about? Do you have thoughts on why or why not to prosecute one or the other? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Adam Stevenson, clinical professor at the UW Law School, looking at former President Trump and current President Biden's respective mishandling of classified documents and how that's handled in the legal system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We have this decision not to prosecute President Biden over documents from when he was vice president, when he left office as vice president. Ongoing prosecution right now, former President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Adam, I want to dig more into the question of why not prosecute Biden and why Trump is being prosecuted. Robert Hur, the counsel, decided not to pursue prosecution against Biden, addressed that in his report. I'm going to quote a couple bits of it here. Quote, most notably, after being given multiple chances to return classified documents and avoid prosecution, Mr. Trump allegedly did the opposite. According to the indictment, he not only refused to return the documents for many months, but he also obstructed justice by enlisting others to destroy evidence and then to lie about it. And then Herr added, in contrast, Mr. Biden turned in classified documents to the National Archives and the Department of Justice, consented to the search of multiple locations, including his homes, sat for a voluntary interview, and in other ways, cooperated with the investigation. Okay, done with extensive quoting there, Adam. How important is that, do you think, to one being prosecuted, one not being prosecuted?
I think it's significant, you know, with the exception perhaps of the memory of willful misconduct or knowing that he had the documents during the 4 years he was not in office. I think the distinction between the cases is the nature of the cooperation or lack thereof between the two different presidents. President Biden did, by all appearances, and according to the special counsel's report, voluntarily provide documents, allow for searches, consented to searches of his residences and different offices, sat for interviews and so forth. President Trump, on the other hand, at least as it's alleged, was less forthcoming, perhaps, in terms of the documents. There were grand jury subpoenas issued requesting the documents, and it eventually culminated in an FBI search warrant being executed where significant numbers of additional documents were uncovered. And that's not only a basis for an independent criminal act itself, as alleged in the indictment, but it's also something that a prosecutor can consider when exercising their discretion. And I think that's an important takeaway just in general from this case that applies to state cases, federal cases, is that prosecutors do have a significant amount of discretion in whether to bring a charge. They definitely consider the standard of proof, what evidence they have, but there are a number of other things to consider in terms of the extent of the nature of the offense, the cooperation or lack thereof of the person who's accused, and certain other considerations. And so I think, as Special Counsel Herr noted, given the nature of the assistance that President Biden offered relative to that of President Trump, that was a significant factor in motivating the decision not to charge.
Let's go back to our callers. Dwayne is with us in Westfield. Dwayne, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Longtime listener, love the show.
Thanks.
Hey, no problem. The thing about it is this, is between Trump and Biden, Trump was him. He was already found guilty. I mean, already guilty that people were trying to destroy the evidence of the stuff that he brought there. Biden didn't. We already know that. That's a fact. So the reason, the choice between one that should get prosecuted, which is Trump, well, that's a no-brainer. But why are people dragging their feet and making a big deal about Biden, which was proven that he did not do it? Because, in my opinion, it's like we all know that presidents can take certain documents back to their personal residence. But Trump's already been proven that he was destroying stuff before the FBI got there.
Dwayne, thanks for the call. Now, there are allegations about what former President Trump did with documents over the course of the investigation. I want to be careful about a word like proven, though, because the trial is still ongoing, Adam.
Exactly correct. These are allegations. They are some very particular allegations, but if proven true at a trial, they are significant. And I think a prosecutor, when exercising discretion, determining whether to charge, they would take a look at that information, how reliable the witness may be that provides it. Is it somehow memorialized or captured in video or in audio? Is it corroborated by additional information or other individuals? And then make a determination of how strongly they feel they can prove something, like, for example, the alleged destruction or falsification of records, for example. And especially comparing that to President Biden's example, especially as it relates to the actual source documents, the papers relating to Afghanistan, there really wasn't much contemporaneous at the same time back in 2017 about President Biden's knowing possession of the document. Special Counsel Herr references one phone call President Biden had with his ghostwriter of his book, where he indicates something about having found the documents, and it may have said classified. I can't recall specifically, but that's really the one item that the investigators had to demonstrate some amount of awareness. And Special Prosecutor Herr indicated that it's entirely possible that a jury could view that as indicative of knowledge, but then perhaps quickly forgetting it or maybe not necessarily indicating as clearly as it might appear that that was knowledge or awareness of that classified information. So it's definitely something that a prosecutor would consider. They'd weigh the pros and cons and how likely it is a jury would accept those that testimony or that evidence as true. But it is yet to be proven.
Dwayne, thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Adam Stevenson from the UW Law School, looking at classified documents cases, comparing and contrasting President Biden and his handling of documents after he left office as vice president, and former President Trump and his case. Now, Adam, the speed of the Trump case here. Now, he leaves office early 2021. That's when this document thing starts. That's when the documents go to Mar-a-Lago, long back and forth between the National Archives and Trump's attorneys. It gets into the Justice Department. The search warrant you mentioned executed, I think, in August of 2022. Here we are. Early 2024, and this case is still, it seems like, languishing in a court. Could you talk about the pace of this investigation and trial?
Sure. It's interesting. Comparing, for example, two of President Trump's federal cases, his case in D.C. and his case in Florida, the case in Florida is moving at a pace a little bit more typical, perhaps, of a federal case, a little slower and more methodical. I think what's also adding to that fact are two different things. One, given the nature of the evidence in the Southern District of Florida case, the classified documents case, there's a significant amount of work that to be done under a law called CIPA, the Classified Information Procedures Act, about balancing the government's interest in keeping certain documents classified and information classified while allowing a defendant access to the evidence that the government may use to prove that they held a certain document. And the court is currently going through the process of working with the prosecutor's office, working with President Trump and his counsel to determine what and to what extent those documents may come in. There's also litigation currently around the identity of witnesses and whether those may be protected, not due to any classification, but due to potential concerns relating to tampering or other matters. So there's definitely been a lot of pretrial litigation in this case, some of it unique to a classified documents case, some of it a little bit more run-of-the-mill. I think the January 6th case out of D.C. is moving much faster, perhaps even than a typical federal case. This one is moving a little bit more normally and maybe a little bit more slower because of the confidential nature of the evidence and some of the complications that arise because of it.
A lay person might say, hey, we might, as Americans, have an interest in the outcome of this case prior to deciding whether a particular person should be president or not over the next, 9 months or so now. Does a court care about that political reality?
So I think a court generally would be concerned about the speedy or at least efficient resolution of a case. But it does have to balance a number of things, one of which is President Trump's due process rights. He needs to be able to put on a full defense to the charges alleged, and the charges alleged have grown during the course of this case. And the government is also justified in trying to keep certain national security matters secret, including some of the most secure involving nuclear technology. And so I think the court is going to be most concerned with balancing those two interests while trying to be as efficient as possible. I think it would be somewhat naive to think that the court isn't aware of the political consequences, but I think in general, we would hope that a court is not necessarily swayed as heavily by them versus those other concerns.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Adam Stevenson, clinical professor and director of the Frank J. Remington Center at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He talked to us today about Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and the mishandling of classified documents and how that plays into decisions to prosecute or not prosecute. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, snow may be on the decline in many parts of the world thanks to climate change, but it can be hard to predict from year to year. A researcher joins the show for a look at the causes and potential impact of the loss of snow cover. And you can get the conversation started right now. Are you seeing less snow in your part of the state, or if you're outside of Wisconsin, wherever you happen to be, is that causing problems for you with a form of recreation, say, or business or tourism in your local community or a place you like to be a tourist in yourself? Is a lack of snow this year in recent years affecting your life in one way or another? Join the conversation with an email right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then listen along tomorrow morning at 7. That's here on the Ideas Network. It's Valentine's Day, whether you're celebrating, avoiding, or ignoring it. Here's one possible romantic activity. Take a trip down to Lover's Lane. Turns out here in Wisconsin, you've got over 40 options. That's according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. For a special Valentine's Day treat, the Journal Sentinel's data team looked at road names around Wisconsin and found 44 roads named Lover's Lane, or something close to that. There's a Lover's Road in the village of Campbellsport and a Lover Lane in the town of Willow Springs. The most lovingest county, Washington County in southeastern Wisconsin, has 7 Lover's Lanes. The longest Lover's Lane in the state is there, 10 miles, starting in Slinger. The tradition goes back to the early days of the car, when young people would park their cars on these quiet roads to hold hands and stuff. If you have a story about a Lover's Lane in your community, the Journal Sentinel wants to hear from you. Check out their reporting and their map at jsonline.com. This one goes out to the lovers in the house. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the American Red Cross declared another emergency blood shortage. We'll take a look at the broader blood donation system and find out why the supply isn't always able to quite keep up. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about discovering who you truly are.
While Joseph Ray Torres of Oneida was on his path of self-discovery, something finally clicked for him. He realized he was two-spirit, which for him meant embracing masculine and feminine identities. Torres talked about this with his adopted nephew and mentee, Corey Carline of Green Bay, during a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
My name is Corey. I am 33 years old. I am an Indigenous Mexican student, doctoral candidate at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
My name is Joseph, age 58. I'm a recent graduate from UWGB. I graduated with a double major in First Nations Studies and Business Administration. I am also Indigenous and Mexican. I identify as a proud two-spirit gay man as well.
When you were growing up, what did your Indigenous identities mean to you?
My mom, she went to a mission school, and so I was raised very Christian, and my dad was Mexican and Pueblo from Dallas, Texas. Because they both dealt with so much racism, even though my mom spoke full-blooded Oneida, she never spoke it to us, and my dad, who was his first language was Spanish, he would not speak it to us. They were both very loving, hardworking parents. But at the same time, I look back and I feel a little bit cheated, not because of anything they did, just because of what they went through. They didn't want us kids to go through that. But I guess I saw other Oneidas and I knew I was Oneida, but I didn't really know what it meant until years later.
What do these identities mean to you now?
Well, they help me keep grounded. They help give me self-confidence. They let me know that I have a place in society, you know, and then coming out as well was very hard. My family took it really well, and my mom, of course, being Christian, was the one that had the hardest time dealing with it. And I was really close to my mom, but because of her Christianity, her response was, believe in the power of prayer. You know, and one of the best gifts I ever received, a friend gave me a book by Walter Williams called Sexual Diversity in Native American Culture, The Flesh and the Spirit. And that really empowered me gave me an identity that more than anything confirmed that a long time ago before Europeans, Christianity, colonization, Two-Spirit people were revered. It was believed we were given special gifts. We were given very high roles in our society. There was no such thing as coming out. It just was. It was believed that the Creator made us, and it was also considered to be gifted because we could understand both the masculine and the feminine side of things. And a lot of times when kids were left orphaned, they were given to a Two-Spirit individual, because in Native American culture, they thought, what better to raise a child than someone that has both the feminine and masculine energy to be both the mother and the father. So, and then just learning more about my culture, just reading books on my own, and especially going to UWGB and majoring in First Nation Studies, I really learned a lot more about my own Oneida culture specifically. It means a lot to me now. I'm proud to be Mexican, Pueblo, Oneida, Two-Spirit, proud to be gay, proud to be everything that I am.
I've had a life-changing gift of your mentorship and advice for as long as I can remember.
Well, I'm very proud of you. You've come a long, long way. So
we're all proud of you, too.
That was Joseph Ray Torres of Oneida and Corey Carline of Green Bay. Their interview was recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is Central Time. The American Red Cross says it's seeing the lowest number of people giving blood in the last 20 years, and as a result, it's facing an emergency blood shortage. This comes after they previously declared an emergency blood shortage this past September. And in 2022, the Red Cross declared a blood crisis as it faced its worst blood shortage in over a decade. They issued similar blood shortage notifications each year, dating back to at least 2016, sometimes multiple times a year. So how does our blood supply system work? Are there ways to avoid these periodic shortfalls? Our next guest researched the structural design and economics of the U.S. blood service industry and is here to help us understand how it works. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you donate blood? If so, what motivates you to give? Do you donate plasma at a for-profit outfit? If you don't donate blood, what would it take for you to give? If you're someone who relies on the blood industry, how are you affected by shortages? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Judson Edwards is dean of the Sorrell College of Business at Troy University. He's editor-in-chief of the Journal of Blood Service Economics. Judson, welcome to Central Time.
So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, as I just mentioned, we've got another warning of a blood shortfall, a crisis. First of all, when we hear an announcement like that, how bad are things? Does that mean, hey, hospitals don't have blood they need to work with, or the pool is running pretty dry and we are not far from that position? How bad are things?
Yeah, I think the second is more accurate. I think they issue a lot of these warnings when they're starting to run particularly low on certain types of blood. And you know, the other thing I think is important for listeners to understand is there really is not a strategic reserve of blood. You know, it's almost just like we saw with the pandemic and a lot of manufacturers that you see today. It's really kind of a just-in-time inventory for the blood centers. And so, you know, I think that really adds to part of their constant request for, you know, more donors.
And it's weird to think of blood as an economic commodity, but in some ways it's helpful to do that. Can you talk about what's unique about blood that makes managing a supply difficult?
Well, it's really a complex issue. The first I would say is that people have to understand that a blood center, most of these are operating as a nonprofit entity. There's roughly 50 independent blood centers and, of course, the Red Cross. And the Red Cross is about 40% of the entire blood market, and with the independent blood centers comprising the other 60. Altruistic approach to getting, donors to come forward to make donations in order to keep the supply going. There's still cost associated with that blood. It all has to be tested. It has to be transported. There are all of these sophisticated contracts. It's not like a typical marketplace where prices change all the time. They're fixed long-range prices. And so the margins are very, very thin for these blood centers. And so what's happening is they continue to get more competitive. I think what happens in the case for people that are donating blood and don't quite understand what these impacts mean, you know, you end up with a marketplace where they're always operating on a very thin margin. And so, you know, they don't want to send out blood to have, you know, test run if they don't have to, because that's an expense that they carry. And there's no guarantee the hospital will take it. You know, most of the contracts that these blood centers have with hospitals are essentially on an as-needed basis. And so they can actually return units to the blood center based on a lot of these contracts. So it's a very complex issue. It goes against everything you think of in terms of a normal market transaction.
As weird as things are and as cobbled together as it feels, Judson, mostly does the system work? Is blood and I guess plasma too there for the most part when we need it?
It is. You know, there's a struggle within, I think, the blood industry itself that, you know, there's this saying there's no such thing as a little bit of government intervention. You have a whole group of these blood centers that want assistance from the government, but they don't necessarily want to have a government-run system. And so blood centers had it really, I say blood centers had it pretty well during the COVID events, because they had the federal government essentially paying for all the units they would collect. And so they were pretty full with cash during the COVID-19 situation. But my understanding from what I hear from a lot of blood centers is where they had some, you know, kind of a cash reserve, that all of that is essentially gone away. And so, you know, it's one of those situations where I think people really need to understand, you know, they're doing very good for society in terms of making these donations, but there's a sophisticated business behind each unit of blood that I think is not commonly known.
A running debate that seems to crop up from time to time, Judson, is what are the benefits of a donation system? Shouldn't we just pay everybody who gives blood and that's going to solve any problems we have? How do we weigh the benefits of a donor system versus you just get paid when you donate blood or plasma?
Yeah, I think this just goes back to, you know, what we've done traditionally. We have some blood centers out there that they give, I consider it the same type of incentive as paying a donor. If they'll give you a gift card for making a blood donation or, you know, that is taking place, to me, that's almost as close to a cash payment as you can get. I do think, though, that we do have a little bit better educated populace out there that does see what's happening with these plasma centers and the amount of dollars that are being paid to donors through plasma. So, you know, I think this kind of voluntary system is pretty traditional for what we see. But I do think over time, the margins and what I would consider a strategic reserve for the blood system is something that these blood centers just cannot take on, you know, without compensation to do it.
And you bring up a distinction I really wanted to make, Judson. We have these plasma centers where you can go and get money for donating plasma. As I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, that's going to a whole different system than what we're talking about, the stuff that's going to end up, say, in hospitals providing treatment for people.
Right. And, you know, what a lot of people don't know is that the plasma industry in the U.S., we're the world's largest exporter of plasma. I mean, we supply, you know, Europe with most of their plasma for, you know, the development of pharmaceutical products. And so, you know, it's a big money industry, and they do extremely well. And so, you know, I do think that it's just a matter of time before the blood centers have to, you know, do more thinking about monetary incentives to keep donors. You know, the other thing, too, that's interesting is that, you know, there's only the O negative units are the ones that most of these blood centers operations really, when I say beat up the donors for, you know, they really want the O-neg donor to come out. But in many cases, these blood centers charge the same price for a hospital for an A-positive unit as they do for an O-negative unit. So in economic terms, you know, of course, when the more scarce an item is, you would think the higher the price. But that's not necessarily true when we talk about blood.
We're talking about the blood donation industry system in the United States with Judson Edwards. He's the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Blood Service Economics and dean of the Sorrell College of Business at Troy University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the current blood donation system in the United States? Are there ways you think it could be improved? How can we get more people to donate blood? Have you been a donor in your life? Are there things that would make you more or less likely to give blood and or plasma? Have you worked in the industry one way or another, collecting blood or using it in the healthcare system? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Judson Edwards, Dean of the Sorrell College of Business at Troy University, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Blood Service Economics. We're talking about the blood donation system in the United States, why organizations like the American Red Cross bring up regular blood shortages as they are currently. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Judson, I wanted to ask about the impact of the pandemic on blood donations. I think there's concern that a lot of people who might have been in the habit of donating blood got out of that habit. Case in point, me. I used to donate way more regularly. I've done it a couple times since the pandemic started, but I got out of that super regular donation system. Is this a big problem?
You know, I really don't believe so. I think what we saw during the pandemic, of course, there were lots of requests for donors during that time. And, you know, as I just mentioned earlier, I think a lot of that was because they could collect as many units as they wanted, and they were going to be compensated for those that they collected. So I'm not sure if, you know, where we were with the pandemic and where we are today, if that's something that we need to think about, some type of strategic blood reserve or however you want to phrase it. But the question will be, how will we pay for that?
Let's bring on a caller. Mike is with us in Ashland. Mike, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Yes, I'm wondering, like 20 years ago when I was donating, they would check your blood pressure first. But recently I've tried to donate and they check your blood count. Has to do with your iron and that and anemia. And I guess they have this cutoff at 13 is the cutoff for donating. And last time I went, I had a 12.6 and was rejected. So I'm curious, if they're so desperate for donations, can't they drop that 13, you know, blood count down to 12 or something?
Mike, thanks for the call. As I understand it, Judson, that's for the donor's safety, making sure you've got that iron couch.
That's correct. And I know that they're very sensitive to all of the different risks associated with drawing blood from donors. And so I do think that would, exactly as you said, that's one of those things where they're really trying to protect the donor.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We heard from David via email. David says, I've given blood since I've been in college over 30 years ago. I'd be interested in what other countries do. So, that's interesting, Judson, comparing and contrast. Are there lessons to learn from other countries and their blood system?
There is. Strangely enough, I just came back from Vietnam and was studying the Vietnamese blood system. And one of the things that they've been really I think one of the strongest in the world is working with younger donors. They've been very, I think, sophisticated with the way they're using social media and the way that they're using some technologies very similar to supply chains, things that you would see like with FedEx and how they distribute blood through different donors across the country. And so there are some things I believe that we could do. But one of the advantages that they have in this case is it's a one single government run blood system, where here in the U.S., of course, as we've discussed, I mean, there's 50 independent blood centers roughly, and then the American Red Cross. So you know, different systems, but I think there's still things we could learn from that system.
Now, you've mentioned a couple times the idea of a strategic blood reserve. Now, I know we have a strategic petroleum reserve in the United States. Petroleum keeps real good. You could just store it underground. What would be the challenges of keeping a blood stockpile in the United States?
Well, you know, the military has done it for years in terms of freezing platelets, that they've been able to do that. So there are some things you can do to extend the life of blood. But overall, you know, I think for us to have this strategic reserve, it could be done within our system now. But there are points within the donation system where it just really does not make any more sense for the blood centers to try to collect more, but rarely will they turn a donor away. So that those are the kind of efficiencies that are built into the system that I think keep the margins where they are, but trying to maintain some storage capacity for blood is a very, you know, very complex issue. But, you know, you're seeing emerging technologies at this recent event that I went to in Washington, D.C., you know, there are people that are in the process now developing artificial blood for, you know, for emergency situations. And I mean, it's just amazing what's going on out there. But it would be a very expensive proposition, I think, just to have all of these units of blood sitting out there across the U.S. every day.
One particularly acute concern I've heard of, Judson, is when you have a major disaster affecting a wide area. You're A, disrupting the donation system, and B, you may have more demand because of injuries sustained during whatever that disaster might be. How do we manage that kind of acute, maybe regional blood crisis?
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about our system that I do think should give us some confidence is for every disaster that you can name we've had, the blood system has been there to meet that need. Typically what happens is they may clear the shelves across some, you know, maybe bringing in and importing some blood from different areas. But usually, you know, the American people come out and support and give more blood during those times of crisis, and enables those areas that just, you know, kind of gave their supply over to where the emergency took place to build theirs back up. So it's a pretty resilient system as it is. And that's, you know, the real problems, I think, come with the testing. You know, there's a limited testing capacity here in the U.S. There are things like blood bags and just some of the normal things that are required to collect blood. We do not stockpile those. I think that would be perhaps an even better place to start than worrying about the blood itself.
Judson, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Judson Edwards, Dean of the Sorrell College of Business at Troy University, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Blood Service Economics. He was with us today for a look at the blood donation system in the United States as the American Red Cross announces another blood shortage in the country. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, sex education can be a tough topic in normal times, and with schools under close scrutiny, it can be even more difficult. A Wisconsin researcher surveyed sex educators around the country for a firsthand look. We'll check out the results and what we're seeing in schools in Wisconsin and beyond. Plus, a lot of large-scale economic indicators look pretty good lately. But Americans have mixed feelings about the economy in major polls. Dig into some of the reasons behind that and share your confidence or lack of confidence in the American economy. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, tax season can be a stressful time with all the paperwork, making sure everything's filed correctly. But what if there were an easier way to do things? A tax law expert weighs in. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.